Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loring. Coming up today, we're going to talk about the cooperative family, how to make your personal relationships better. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But first, two or three listener comments about yesterday's program. We're going to hear those comments right now. And later on in the program, we'll take some more live phone calls. But here's two comments that came in after yesterday's program.
Hi, this is Jim Anderson in St. Pete. I know very well about trees being torn down for development, as it happened to a wonderful 60-foot-high tree on the other side of our alley that provided fantastic shade for a lot of houses and for our backyard. That tree got torn down towards the middle of the development of this lot, right at the time that the state got rid of the home rule that would have protected that tree. We had talked with the city forester who was working with the developer to save the tree. We thought it was going to be saved. Too late. That tree is gone. It's going to take another 50 years before we get the shade back. It's really a shame.
Well, that actually was one comment, but it came in after yesterday's program where we got into a discussion about the state legislature preempting local government laws and regulations. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. This first part of the program, we're going to hear an interview with Calvin Armerding, who is the author of a new book called The Cooperative Family. And it looks at how to make relationships between you and your partner better and you and your children better. We're going to hear that interview right now. And Calvin Armerding is taking place in a conference that is based in Tampa, the Tampa Bay area this weekend. It's going to be held virtually. We'll hear about that at the end of the program. But let's listen to the interview with South Carolina therapist Calvin Armerding about his book, The Cooperative Family, next here on WMNF 88.5 FM. Calvin Armerding, welcome to WMNF. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me.
Your book is entitled The Cooperative Family. What does that mean, cooperative family?
Well, in large part, what the book centers around is a contrast between cooperative ways of relating to one another and competitive ways of relating to one another. And really what I'm doing in the book is trying to expose how family members and a whole host of relationships, you know, parenting relationships, sibling relationships, marital and partnership relationships, and even intergenerational relationships, how we compete with one another, trying to get a one-up, a leg up on one another, and how that causes us a lot of trouble. And so what I really am trying to do after exposing those competitions is to try to encourage people to be more cooperative in how they relate to one another, taking on life more as a group challenge, as something that we can help each other with rather than just trying to, you know, keep our heads above water by pushing others down.
Is competition kind of natural in relationships? I mean, doesn't it happen in practically every relationship, whether it's a marriage or a family relationship or relationships between generations? That there's always somebody who wants to prove that they're better than the others.
Absolutely. I think it is, in so many senses, it's kind of our natural state to want to do that. And I should also mention that I do not want to just cast competition as a bad thing in and of itself. I mean, I love competitive sports, and to varying degrees, I'm a strong believer in the free market, and so, you know, there are certainly ways in which competition can be really beneficial, and certainly isn't a problem. And as you're mentioning, it's unavoidable to some extent. The question really is whether the competitions that we engage in are subordinate to cooperative goals or not. So, in other words, there's more than one way to compete. And so while there might be a kind of natural competition that does exist, what we can do just as human beings is to subordinate those competitive drives, which aren't necessarily bad, to cooperative goals that put us in concert and cooperation with one another rather than just, you know, it's almost like playing King of the Hill when you're a kid, where, you know, there's only room for one person at the top of the hill. And if you're at the top of the hill, what you're spending your time doing is fending off all the challengers. And if you're not on the top of the hill, what you're trying to do is to pull the other person down so you can get up there. And that's not the only way that we can compete and strive for excellence.
Competition can be very destructive.
Absolutely. And I think particularly when it's not subordinated to cooperative goals. So let's take something like, and by the way, I'm by no means an economist, but let's just take, you know, kind of basic theory of the free market. Okay, so somebody has a product out there, you know, they make they make globes, and they sell them for $20, and somebody else looks at it and they say, well, you know, I think I can make a better globe, and actually I could sell them for $15, and so then they do that, and now there's some competition in the system. And what you would, you know, in theory, what would happen is that would drive the price down and you'd get better and better globes for cheaper and cheaper. And that's good for everybody, right? I mean, the consumer wins in a lot of ways. Even the companies win. And, you know, it's not to say that every company would survive, but in large part, you're just moving progress forward. You're pushing things forward. But sometimes what that turns into is, it's not just, well, let's make a better globe for cheaper to help out the community. It's how can we crush this other company because we have to be on top. And this is when you see things going pretty haywire and things being destructive, not just for companies, but also for consumers and probably most importantly for communities. And that's, you know, a kind of big picture image of what is happening in families in a day-to-day living kind of way. You know, people get up and they compete, and if those competitions aren't subordinate to cooperative goals, things can get very destructive. Yeah.
And that kind of competition in business is not always good for workers or for the environment either. So there are problems.
Absolutely.
Lots of problems with the competition. Let's talk about relationships and marriages and partnerships. You say that the common battlegrounds in those kind of relationships are money, sex, kids, household responsibilities. I'll add one more, and I know you've thought about this. I saw somebody post on Facebook the other day, who's smarter in the relationship? That's a battleground. But there are common, as you point out, there are common battlegrounds: money, sex, kids, household responsibilities. How do we move from being competitive in those areas to more cooperative?
Yeah. Well, let's just take something like money. So the reality is I've got, let's say in my marriage with my wife, I've been married for coming up on, what will it be, 12 years in May. And, you know, I grew up in a certain environment where we treated money a certain way. My wife, she grew up in a different environment where they treated money a certain way. Money means different things to each of us. To me, it means something like freedom. To my wife, it means something like security. And so we each have our own ideas about money, how to manage it, how to spend it, how to save it, what our budget should look like, you know, all those kinds of things. And of course, both those things, they're perfectly valid. But if I engage in conversations about money in a more competitive fashion with my wife, what I'm trying to do is to make sure that we do it my way. And so one of the things that requires me to do is to denigrate her way whenever it differs from my way. And so it becomes this, yeah, just very competitive, you know, striving thing. And what ends up happening is that we're not even paying attention to the demands of the situation on us, the financial demands that are placed on us. How do we pay the bills? How do we keep food on the table? How do we save for our retirements? Our kids aren't, you know, hosting us in their basement with a bunch of bitterness and resentment. You know, those are really the demands of the situation. Those are the demands that life puts on us. And rather than attending to those, what we end up doing is attending to the demands of the individual. So attending to my demands. No, our budget has to be color-coded red, green, and blue. And these are the priorities, and this is, you know, the credit card company that we should work with or not work with, or this is No, we can't take a loan to purchase a car. We can only pay cash. All of which might be splendid ideas, but if that's what I'm most interested in doing is ensuring that we do it my way, we're really not paying attention to the demands that life is placing on us.
And if one partner demands that you do it his way or her way, the other partner feels diminished and they feel powerless.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the things that a psychologist named Alfred Adler let us know is that people will not stand to remain in a position of inferiority. So let's say that I, quote unquote, win the argument, about a budget being color-coded a certain way with my wife. Well, now she feels inferior. And one of the things that we know about human beings is that if they feel inferior, they're going to find a way to not feel that anymore. And so one of the things I've done at that point is I've invited blowback from my wife. There's at some point she will get me back. She will, find a way to get on top of me in some other argument or she'll let me win, but be resentful toward me. And by the way, I'm not speaking so much about my wife, but I'm speaking
okay.
Theoretically.
I think we understand. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, no, just to understand that there is blowback. There, it's not just, oh, I won and it's the right way and so now we can go on our merry way. We don't get to go on our merry way. We're, only further embroiled in competition and we're further distracted from the demands that life is placing on us.
We're talking about the book, The Cooperative Family, with its author, Calvin Armerding, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Well, let's move to families where there are kids in the family. What do you think about this idea of for a child who does her chores or his chores, you give them a reward, but if they don't do their chores, you punish them. What do you think about this idea of reward and punishment?
Well, rewards and punishment, they're really effective at training compliance. You can shape behavior pretty well using reward and punishment. One of the things that that reward and punishment is not very good at doing is shaping character. I think back to when I was growing up and at some point I would eat my green beans because I wanted some ice cream after dinner. I certainly did not learn to love vegetables. And in fact, what I figured out how to do was to cut the green beans up into pill-shaped little pieces. And then I would take them like pills. I'd put them in the front of my teeth, not letting my tongue touch them, and then take a big swig of water and just, wash it down. And so I was complying, with the rule. My parents were effective in shaping a certain behavior, but they didn't teach me to love vegetables. They didn't teach me to eat healthy. They taught me to comply. And by the way, that's no big indictment of my parents. It's what a lot of folks are doing. And so, to understand that one of the things that we really need to do with children is not to just shape certain behaviors, because the trouble with that is that as soon as they are out from under the, let's call it an umbrella of our reward and punishment structures, what's really going to shine through is character. And, so this is why you see some children who are splendidly behaved all the way up through high school, and then they go to college, and they just absolutely lose their minds. I mean, they're engaging in all kinds of unsavory behaviors that the parents wouldn't like, and they find every opportunity to show adults of every kind, not just their parents, that they're in charge of them and no one can make them do anything. In part, that's because the character hasn't been shaped, and rewards and punishments are not very good at that. So I think it's not so much that rewards and punishments are bad, but we do need to understand that they're exceptionally limited in setting our children up well for success. There are times for rewards and punishments, but as kind of your staple parenting strategy, you just have to understand that all you're getting out of your kids at best is compliance, and you're not really building much character.
And that's because the kids have failed to internalize the importance of what you're asking them to do? Or when you talk about character, tell me a little bit more. How do you instill this idea of character into kids if you're not using reward and punishment.
Absolutely. So one of the things that I advocate is the use of logical and natural consequences. So natural consequences, they're pretty easy to understand. If I want my son, Truman, he's five, he's not tying shoes yet, but we're coming right up on that. And if I want him to tie his shoes when he runs around, well, one of the things I could do, you know, is if he's running around with his shoes untied, I could punish him with a lecture or with, taking away a privilege or something like that. Or I could just let him run around. And at some point, what's going to happen is he's going to step on that shoelace and he's going to bite it. And he's going to bite it pretty hard. And at that point, I'm, as a dad, able to go to him really as a comforter and to say, oh my goodness, that's so tough. That looked like it really hurt. Come here, let's figure it out. Notice how strong your body is. You're going to be okay. Now, what do you think you'd like to do next time? Now, what I'm doing is I'm putting it on him. And so now I've utterly avoided any kind of power struggle, right? There's no sense of, well, I probably would have tied my shoes, but Dad told me that I have to, and I don't want to give Dad the idea that that he can boss me around and tell me what to do with myself. So watch this, Dad. I'll run around with my shoes untied. You'll see you can't make me. If I go this natural consequences route, he really feels not just what he should do, but he also knows why. Because his body hurts because he just fell on the floor. Now, obviously, there's limits to that. I'm also not going to let my daughter, Ruby, who's three, I'm not just going to let her play down in the street with cars driving by at 35 miles an hour. You know, and we'll say, well, we'll let her figure it out. You know, she'll get hit by a car, and that'll teach her that's a bad place to play. Obviously, I can't let her do that. But what I can do is use a logical consequence. And kind of the rule with logical consequences, there's three R's. They need to be respectful. They do need, you know, to give the child the sense that they do have some level of choice. You know, that they do have some power to decide what it is that they're going to do with themselves, as limited as it may be. But we really need to pass that on to them. They need to be reasonable. You know, parents who ground their children for 2 months when they're 5 minutes late for curfew, it's really not reasonable whatsoever, really for anybody, maybe most of all the parents, to ground a child for 2 months. And then lastly, them being related to, you know, in other words, the consequence should fit the misbehavior. And so rather than taking away my daughter's screen time for the day when she's playing down in the street, that's pretty hard for her to connect those dots. But if I go down there and I, let's say, pick her up as she's trying to go in the street and say, okay, it looks like today we're not ready to handle playing outside. We'll find something to do inside. Now, she might not love that, but what I'm doing is it's very easy to connect the two. It's not some quantum leap. These are the limits of playing outside. Let's get you inside. And so really what I'm talking about with character, Rob, is just getting kids clued in to the demands of life rather than the demands of a parent. The kid who trips and falls over his own shoelaces understands that life demands not dad, but life demands that if he runs around, he ties his shoes. And my daughter playing down the street understands that life demands that there be a distinction between safe and unsafe places to play. More than it's dad's demand. And I think that's really what I'm talking about with character. And of course, that extends beyond playing in the street and tying your shoes.
Mm-hmm. Just getting back to punishment for a moment, in your book, The Cooperative Family, you have a whole list of things that happen if you're just hooked on punishment for the kids. You talk about punishment makes enemies and scaredy cats, not good people. Punishments are always personal. Punishment pushes behavior into the shadows. Punishments model bullying tactics by the parents, and then the children take around and either employ or fearfully avoid those bullying tactics, and they invite blowback, as you mentioned before, in relationships. So there's a whole list of mm-hmm. possible problems with punishment.
Absolutely. Parents who use reward and punishment 9 times out of 10 are just trying to do best by their kids. And it's hard sometimes when I do parent consultations to see that they have no idea what it is that they're inviting into the relationship. And what's great about that is that as soon as you can let them know, hey, when you use that punishment, it does occur to me that that really puts you in power struggle with them, and I'm not sure that that's really what you want to do. What's another way that we can go about this? They're fairly quick to respond to that, unless they are very, very committed to staying in competition with their kids. You can reorient them quite quickly, and that's wonderful. But, yeah, some of what I put in the book is just laying that out for parents so they can understand, A, there's another way to go about doing this, but B, some of what's going on here or what may be going on in your family is just a perfectly unintended consequence of heavy use of punishment and reward.
Well, we're talking with Calvin Armerding, and his book is called The Cooperative Family. This is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. So do you view the family as kind of a team where everybody's got a role and let's say there's no coach, you know, you've just got players? I mean, how do you view the family?
Yeah, very much that way. I mean, I certainly think ideally how the family would function is as a group in which, let's say, you know, I've got a family of four. How it would ideally work is that my liabilities as a person, and I have plenty, are somewhat buffered and, let's say, scaffolded by the strengths of, you know, the other members of the family. And then my strengths also would kind of chip in and help out and contribute, not to me doing well just as an individual, but to the family doing well as a group. And in that sense, absolutely, there's, you know, just a team approach. If we think about something like a basketball team, you know, point guards make terrible centers. You know, they tend to be shorter and not quite as muscular, and they just don't, you know, they don't take up quite so much space. But they're really good at what they do. And so rather than the point guard running around, you know, looking at the center and saying, well, can't you be shorter and quicker and just, you know, and shoot better from the three-point line, rather just respecting the strength that the center has while respecting their own strength, understanding their liabilities and understanding the center's liabilities, and then cooperating together so that the team as a whole does well, and the team does tend to do well when point guards play point guard and centers play center.
Mm. But there's people out there that think, okay, the father's got to be in charge in a traditional family. Father's got to be in charge, and you can't have the kids participating in decision making because then you're going to have anarchy. And so,
right.
and you know, depending on, you know, what your religious beliefs are, sometimes the woman is in second place in a traditional marriage. So, you know, everybody's got to listen to the dad. I mean, that a lot of people, that's part of their religious heritage. They believe that that's the way it's got to be.
Yeah, no question. You know, and I grew up in a, not that my parents weren't exceptionally heavy-handed, but I think I grew up in certainly a community in which parental authority was, you know, that horn really got tooted quite a bit. And by the way, I certainly don't want to advocate for a world or a family in which something like parental authority doesn't exist. I set limits for my children, and at some point I have some final say on certain matters. But I do think that there's been a little bit too much of the parental authority idea promoted, and here's what it really turns into is that it's competitive. You know, it's not about how can I help you flourish as a person, young child. It's more how can I stay in power? How can I puff out my chest and make sure that things go my way? Rather than looking out really for the well-being of the family and for the kids. And I see that quite a bit show up in my office. And you know, let's even say that a parent's right about what they're doing, but they're engaging in it in a competitive fashion. Let's take something like curfew. You know, you got a 16-year-old and you say, okay, be home by 10:30, and the kid thinks that's a terrible idea. Well, there's a way to go about that in a cooperative fashion. There's a way to go about it in a competitive fashion. And a cooperative way to handle that would be to say, okay, look, I do understand. Really, if you leave this house with the car, it's true. Like, I can't control when you come home. All I'm going to do is I'm going to let you know what I'm going to do if you show up after 10:30. And what that's doing, it's not anarchy. It's not no limit setting. It's not any of that. But it is just modeling to a child mutual respect of, hey, you can't make me and I can't make you. But I certainly can control my behavior, and then you'll have to decide how you want to control yours. And there, you know, there's consequences. There are, you know, whatever written into that, but it's not so punitive, and it's not just about power grab. It's not about jostling for who sits at the top of the hierarchy in the family, but rather figuring out how we can attend to the concerns of the family, one of which is, gosh, how can we know that everybody's safe by, you know, 11 p.m.
What would you
so
say?
That we can all get some sleep.
Yeah. So what would you say to that 16-year-old? I mean, when you say, I'll tell you what I'm going to do, what would be the position that you would take that would maybe wake that 16-year-old up?
Well, let's say they came home at, you know, 11:30, something like that. First of all, one of the things I'd want to do is to have a conversation with a kid about when would be reasonable to come home, and if possible, come to an agreement with them about that. It may be that there's just, you know, everybody's really got their heels dug in, and that agreement can't be come to. And so maybe then I have to say, okay, well, my expectation is that you come home at 10:30. And here's what I'm going to do, kiddo. Depending on when you come in, you know, if you come home after 10:30, we're just going to have to sit down and we're going to talk through. We're definitely going to talk through that so we can figure out, you know, what's going on. The second thing is this, is if you come home just really late, your mom and I, we're going to have to figure out what we want to do about loaning you the car. Because we do, you know, I got to wake up for work, and it's, I don't feel good going to sleep not knowing where you are. And so we're just going to have to kind of, you know, reconsider that and sort out, we might even have to, you know, just think about maybe we need to drive you some places, and we know that that wouldn't be ideal, but you'll decide what it is that you want to do. So it's just much more focused on how I'm going to respond as a parent rather than on how my child behaves as a child. You know, you mentioned religious dispositions. One of the things that, you know, I live in an area with a lot of conservative evangelicals, and they come and they say, well, but the Bible says, you know, that children should obey their parents. And I say, well, I certainly don't dispute that. It is pretty interesting that the command is given to children rather than to adults. In other words, the verse does not read, parents, make your children obey you. That's not how it reads. And so if we give that responsibility to the kids and then attend to our responsibilities as parents, things tend to turn out a bit more cooperative.
So you don't show your kids reels of video of horrible car crashes of teenagers involved staying out after 10:30. Okay.
I don't think that that's typically very effective. You know, I heard a lot of horror stories about drinking alcohol when I was growing up. And then I remember having my first underage drinking experience, and it was absolutely splendid. I mean, I had a blast, and please don't hear me advocating underage drinking, but I'm just observing that I think some of the horror stories, when they're inconsistent with experience, they're very easy to just marginalize and invalidate, you know, particularly in, let's say, a teenager who doesn't have all that much of a frontal lobe on their brain yet. It's just very easy to say, oh my gosh, you know, that's parents overreacting, and who knows if those things are even true. I just had a great time.
But you didn't drive, and your friends didn't drive, and you didn't drive at that point, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Calvin, one more question, and thank you for doing this interview. One more question before we go, and that is, in a lot of families, when you've got siblings, especially if they're if they come close together, if they're born close together, there's a lot of sibling rivalry in some families. Mm-hmm. And how do you make sure that, you know, let's say you've got two, three, or four kids in the family, or maybe more, how do you make sure that sibling rivalry doesn't become a problem?
Well, I think, you know, one really important bit of low-hanging fruit here is let's not compare kids. You know, it is so tempting, first of all, as a parent to compare kids. You know, let's say you've got a high performer in school and you got another kid who's, you know, scraping by with C minuses. It is so tempting at moments of intense frustration to say, why can't you just be like your brother? Why can't you just be like your sister? You know, I never have any trouble with them doing their homework. Look at them. They're so diligent. They were able to do this. It is just so tempting. And obviously, you know, that really, I think, can stir up quite a bit of sibling rivalry. I think the other thing we can do proactively is just to provide children with a sense that they belong and that they are significant. I think those two things in particular. So let's say, there's kind of a classic story of, you know, young toddler and mom has a baby. Well, guess who's getting all the attention? You know, the baby's getting all the attention and to some extent, rightfully so. You know, I mean, babies are just, you know, brand new infants are incredibly needy. So parents really do need to attend to that. But just little things like asking an older sibling to say, hey, could you grab me a diaper and bring it down here? That would be helpful. And then, you know, they bring it. Wow, you're a real helper right now. Thank you so much. That means a lot. You know, to ask their opinion about things, to, you know, even if their opinion isn't all that, you know, to ask your three-year-old, well, where do you think we should go eat to dinner tonight? I mean, maybe the only restaurant they know is McDonald's, and that's what they say, you know. Well, ask them anyways. And there's something about that where they sense, oh, I have a place here. I'm important. And I think a lot of what sibling rivalry is about is that there's a sense of scarcity. There's, you know, there's no, I have to defeat my sibling in order to have a place here, to belong, and to have any semblance of meaning and importance in the family. And if that can kind of just be nipped in the bud by providing kids proactively with a sense of belonging and significance, you can do away with quite a bit of sibling rivalry.
Well, the book is The Cooperative Family, and its author, Calvin Armerding, is our guest, and this is WMNF in Tampa. Calvin, thanks for coming on WMNF.
Absolutely, and can I make a quick mention about the Florida Adlerian conference is coming up? Yeah, so later this week, all of this book, it's based on the psychology of Alfred Adler. There are local Adlerian societies all over the country, but the Florida Society there in Tampa, we're having a conference this weekend. A bunch of speakers I'll be presenting actually on this topic. I'll have more to say about it, and people are welcome. FloridaAdlerian.org, I believe, is the website.
Calvin, thanks a lot. Thanks for coming on WMNF.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, that was therapist Calvin Armerding, and Calvin practices in South Carolina. He's written a new book called The Cooperative Family, and he's taking part in the Adlerian Psychology Conference that takes place this weekend. It's virtual, and you can find out more at adlerflorida.org. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Thanks a lot for tuning in. We're going to open up the phone lines and take your phone calls, and we might as well talk about anything that's on your mind. There's a lot of issues out there I want to mention as we start. And when we take your phone calls, the number to call, 813-239-9663. Our email address, dj@wmnf.org. Well, news out of the Capitol, some of the latest news out of the Capitol regarding the possibility that QAnon may strike somehow. The Capitol Police in Washington, D.C. are asking that the National Guard, that they stay guarding at the U.S. Capitol for another 2 months to provide security. The Associated Press has learned the new proposal is being reviewed by the Pentagon, but apparently they think that the threat is ongoing, and so they want soldiers to guard the Capitol for another 2 months. Law enforcement today is on high alert around the Capitol in Washington after intelligence uncovered a possible plot by a militia group to storm it again. The threat appears to be connected to the far-right conspiracy theory promoted by QAnon supporters that Donald Trump will rise again to power to take the presidency today. The original inauguration day under the U.S. Constitution that was changed during the administration of Ulysses Grant. Online chatter identified by authorities included discussions among members of the anti-government militia group, the Three Percenters, concerning possible plots against the Capitol today. But so far, at least as I speak right now, things are peaceful and quiet in the Capitol. But if something breaks, we'll let you know about it. The QAnon conspiracy is going to be the topic in the next hour when Jan and Shelley come on Midpoint. So if you're interested in cults and the QAnon conspiracy, stick around because Jan and Shelley will be talking about it in the next hour. Number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits edged higher last week to 745,000, a sign that many employers continue to cut jobs here in the U.S. despite a drop in confirmed viral infections and evidence that the overall economy is improving. The unemployment numbers went up by about 9,000 from the previous week. All told, 4.3 million Americans are receiving traditional state unemployment benefits. Footage of that brutal crackdown on protests against the coup in Myanmar has unleashed outrage and calls for a stronger international response. Videos showed security forces shooting a person at point-blank range and chasing down and savagely beating demonstrators. Violence came the day 38 people were killed. Protesters in Myanmar still return to the streets today to denounce the military's February 1st takeover. And again, if you want to comment, our phone number, 813-239-9663. There's a lot of other big news I want to tell you about, but let's go to the phones and just see what Ted in Elfers wants to talk about. Hi, Ted, you're on. What's on your mind today? Ted, did you drop off? Ted. Well, somehow we lost Ted. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. There's an interesting controversy going on, and the Florida Secretary of Agriculture is holding a press conference right now to talk about it. There is more reporting that the governor's office has shown favoritism when it comes to who gets the COVID-19 vaccines. The Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald are reporting right now that a wealthy Keys enclave, the Ocean Reef Club in the Florida Keys, received COVID vaccines in January before almost everybody else in the state received them. And I'm just reading from the story in the Times. As Florida's eldest residents struggled to sign up to receive their first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, nearly all those age 65 and older in the wealthy gated enclave in the Florida Keys called the Ocean Reef Club had been vaccinated by mid-January, according to an email newsletter obtained by the Miami Herald. Ocean Reef Club is an exclusive neighborhood that's arguably one of the highest security private communities in the nation. It's also home to many wealthy donors to the Florida Republican Party and home to many GOP candidates, including, Governor Ron DeSantis. In fact, the only people from Key Largo who gave to DeSantis's political committee live in Ocean Reef, which tells you how exclusive it is. All 17 of them had given the governor contributions of $5,000 each through December of last year, according to the Division of Elections. And on February 25th, one resident of Ocean Reef, Bruce Rauner, the former Republican governor of Illinois and former chair of the Chicago-based private equity firm GTCR, increased his contribution and wrote a check to our Republican governor for $250,000. And since Governor DeSantis started using the state's vaccine initiative to steer special pop-up vaccinations to select communities, including in Manatee County and Sarasota and Charlotte County, his political committee has raised $2.7 million in the month of February alone, more than any other month since he first ran for governor in 2018. So the question is there favoritism when it comes to giving vaccines to people here in Florida? Certainly the vaccine program is a mess. And I think a lot of people are confused by the way vaccines are being handed out here in Florida. The CVS pharmacy chain is vaccinating Florida teachers who are under the age of 50, going around state orders limiting coronavirus inoculations to teachers over 50. The chain also began vaccinating daycare and preschool teachers yesterday. Governor DeSantis has not yet opened up the vaccination program to them, but CVS is giving inoculations in two dozen cities across the state. CVS says it's following Biden administration guidelines. So at least one corporation going around what the governor has ordered. And a lot of progressive mayors and governors around the country have decided that preschool teachers and daycare staff and teachers of all ages should be given the vaccines. But that's not yet been the policy here in Florida. Some corporations going around that. Again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Bill Grace is our phone producer today. And let's go to Jim in St. Petersburg. Jim, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Hey, I happen to know something about the Ocean Reef Club from way, way back when. You know who used to live there? B.B. Rebozo.
Oh, Richard Nixon's pal.
Yeah, his friend, his buddy.
Yeah.
And they used to land cocaine in planes at the airstrip there. It has its own airstrip, or did then.
Now, Jim, I'm curious how you know that.
Well, I just know, I just know people who knew at the time what was going on there. They were not, you know, part of the thing. They just knew what was going on. Somebody who worked there.
The AP story I read said it's one of the highest security places in the nation. I mean, back when you were going there, was it high security?
Well, no. It was. This was like the 80s, the late 70s, the 80s, that kind of thing. So it was, you know, I didn't even actually ever go to the place. But I've been by it a few times, and I just know that this was the case. And the fact that B.B. Rebozo lived there alone is, you know, damnable enough. You know, he was the mob. And I think that they probably, over time, have increased the security there and made it more exclusive. It's got easy access to Miami. You know, it's right there at the top of the Keys, at the very top of the Keys.
Yeah. All right, I've never been there, but I'll have to drive by myself. All right, Jim, thanks a lot.
Okay.
Thank you. All right, good to hear from you. And if you want to comment about anything that you've heard here so far, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. I haven't been to the Ocean Reef Club. Nobody's invited me to go. There's an interesting story, and I'm pulling this story from a website called Protocol, and it covers business. It's a business page and covers startups. And this is a story that just appeared on the website Protocol. And the headline is, "The most engaging political news on Facebook? Far-right misinformation is the answer." And there's a new study out. In the months before and after the 2020 election, far-right wing pages that are known to spread misinformation consistently garnered more engagement on Facebook than any other partisan news, according to a New York University study published yesterday. The study looked at Facebook engagement for news sources across the political spectrum between August of last year and January of this year, and found that on average, far-right pages that trade in misinformation raked in 65% more engagement per follower than other far-right pages that aren't known for spreading misinformation. So misinformation sells on Facebook. Okay, that's what this NYU study says. That finding was specific to the far right. In every other category, including far left, slightly left, center, and slightly right, misinformation pages saw significantly less engagement than non-misinformation pages of the same political slant. So it looks like if you're on the far left, if you're slightly left, you're center, or you're slightly right, you don't tend to share misinformation when you're on Facebook. And reading again from the Protocol website, the research cast doubt on Facebook's efforts to limit the spread of election misinformation leading up to Election Day in November and in the aftermath of the January attack on the U.S. Capitol. So you can see that story on the Protocol website. I think what's interesting and one of the big takeaways from that is Facebook is still a prime mover when it comes to misinformation from conservative groups, from far-right groups. And we always hear this talk that Facebook is censoring conservative opinions, but they were used well, according to this NYU study, to trade misinformation. Let's go to Kathy in Webster, who worked at Ocean Reef. Kathy, thanks. What do you know about Ocean Reef?
Well, the guy that said there was no security at the place, you can tell he was never there. If you went in by car, you had to go through a gate. There was security at the airport, and any yachts coming in through the marina, they knew they were coming in. I mean, that place had security, and this was back in the mid-70s, something like that, when I was there.
Yeah, and Kathy, you worked there. So what kind of folks can afford to live at Ocean Reef?
Rich people. When I worked there, that, like I said, it was back in the 70s. You couldn't use cash at it. Everything was done off of a card that was assigned to you when you signed up and paid your, you know, thousands and thousands of dollar dues, which were probably, but I mean, he was right about B.B. Rebozo. I mean, I went out and watched Jackie Gleason tee off on the golf course and met Sammy Davis Jr. there. But, I mean, the security, that's what got me.
Well, Kathy, when you hear this story that the governor apparently gave preference to giving vaccines to people that live in Ocean Reef.
I wouldn't doubt it. Yeah. Because, like I said, I mean, the average person is not going to go in there. I was an employee, and there were certain places we weren't even allowed to go on the property.
What was going on there? What do you think was going on there?
It's just the rich people didn't want to be associated with them.
With the workers?
With the workers. I mean, if you were to be going, you know, over to the little store or something and talk to somebody and you said that you worked there, they would turn their back. That was the end of that. I mean, you know.
Yeah, turned up their nose at you. All right. Kathy, thanks a lot. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, great to hear from you. And let's go to Lee in Spring Hill. Hi, Lee, you're on WMNF. What would you like to say?
Well, I got a question. The MAGA ones are the anti-maskers, anti-vaxxers. Well, how come they keep cutting in line?
Why do these rich donors to Republican causes want to get vaccines when they're the ones that are dismissive of vaccines and
right.
coronavirus? I don't know. I haven't asked them. I don't know why.
Well, it's a self-evident question. They're worried about dying. So when the philosophy goes out the window, when their dear fearless leader also got the shot, but he got it in private.
That's true. That was an interesting story. Before he left the White House, the president himself got the COVID-19 vaccine. Lee, thanks a lot. Thanks for pointing that out.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Take care.
There's another big story I want to tell you about. Yesterday, I mean, there's ongoing hearings in Washington. They've shut down today because of the threat from the radicals, from the militants that want to overthrow the government. But there were more hearings yesterday on the siege of the Capitol. And one of the people that testified yesterday was Army Major General William Walker. He testified that Michael Flynn's younger brother, was on the phone call while the Capitol was being overwhelmed by violent insurrectionists on January 6th. The Army had previously denied Flynn's presence on the call D.C. Police Chief Steve Sund placed, requesting backup from the National Guard to help secure the building. Not only was Lieutenant General Charles Flynn on the call that took place just before 2 o'clock that day, he was one of the people arguing that the optics of having the National Guard show up to protect Congress and Capitol and the Capitol would not be good. It took over 3 hours for the optics of not having them there to get bad enough to send them in. So it took more than 3 hours for the National Guard to be sent into the U.S. Capitol. Here's General Walker testifying yesterday, and this is a revelation that until yesterday, nobody knew.
With the District of Columbia National, the District of Columbia leaders, the deputy mayor, Chief Sun, Dr. Rodriguez, who was talking about optics, were General Flynn and General Pyatt. And they both said it wouldn't be in their best military advice to advise the Secretary of the Army to have uniformed Guards members at the Capitol during the election confirmation.
So Michael Flynn's brother, Charles Flynn, who's a lieutenant general, was on this call arguing against sending National Guard to the U.S. Capitol on the January 6th invasion day. And Michael Flynn, of course, the disgraced national security advisor to Donald Trump, who argued to Trump that Trump should institute martial law in order to stay in power. So his brother was involved in delaying the National Guard going to rescue people at the U.S. Capitol. Let's take another phone call, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Jeremiah in Sarasota. Hi, Jeremiah. You're on MNF. Thanks for calling.
Hey, how's it going today?
Good. What's going on?
Well, I just wanted to comment on the private vaccination pop-ups.
Mm-hmm.
From one of my job sites, actually turned into one this week. And from my observation, it's a good thing. If the goal is to get as many people vaccinated as soon as possible, a lot of these communities were... You're a member of an association, and the association takes responsibility for booking all the appropriate crowd control and nurses and does the paperwork and helps, you know, elderly people in this case show up and register in person and get the shot the next day. And I see that as being a privilege, but I don't see it as being a problem. And that's all I have.
Yeah, and Jeremiah, tell us about the community where this is happening, and what's the cost of the houses, and what's the income of the folks that live in this community?
It's a retirement community. It's a large mobile home community. So I would say, you know, fairly average.
So it's a mobile home community. So what's the name of the community, if you could tell us?
Oh, it's the Colony Cove.
The Colony Cove. Okay, and it's in Sarasota.
It's in Ellington.
Ellington, okay.
And they're doing a great job. And from my observation, like, my mom finally got her second shot this week, and we were excited about that. But it was like trying to get floor seats to a dead show. You had to be on.
Well, you know, I've talked to so many people who have trouble getting the vaccine, who are on paper eligible to get the vaccine. And one person... described it to me, and she's not the first one, but she describes it like the Hunger Games. Like she's on the phone for hours or trying to get online for hours, and she can't get it, and yet she is eligible for this. So, this is what I wonder, Jeremiah. Why don't they just say, we're going to set up vaccine sites at every elementary school, high school, and middle school, and we're going to do it every afternoon from 5 to 9 o'clock for people at work. And we're going to do it every morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. for seniors. And why don't we just open up every gymnasium or at least the parking lot of the school and say, this is where you can go to get your vaccines. And everybody's welcome. Why don't they do that?
My guess is, to play devil advocate, to the public servants that are administering this stuff, is we are, as a state, administering all the vaccines every day. So if there's only so much, and we're expending them all every day, there might be a more equitable way to expend them, but there's no surplus at this time. I think those are all great ideas, and.
Yeah, you know, there are reports that Publix has hundreds of thousands of vaccines, but they haven't revealed how they're giving them out.
And, I have no comment on that.
I'm not sure. I don't think there's really transparency. And Jeremiah, thanks a lot. I don't think there's really transparency in the number of vaccines we have, in where they go, and who gets to distribute them. And then when you've got a wealthy community like the Ocean Reef Club or some of these communities in Manatee County getting them and folks in low and moderate income communities not getting them, it raises a whole host of questions about the fairness of the way the vaccine's being distributed. Anyway, that's the way I see it. If you want to comment about the show today, call us up 813-238-8001 and record your comment about the show on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow at 11 o'clock, right here on 88.5 WMNF in Tampa. Thanks to Bill Grace, our phone producer today. Stick around in the next hour, more about the QAnon conspiracy, more about cult-like fealty to Donald Trump. When you hear the Midpoint program, Janet and Shelley will be talking about those two really important topics. So stick around. Thanks for listening. This is WMNF in Tampa.